A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about weather prediction. Not the app on your phone, but the whole intellectual arc of trying to calculate what the atmosphere will do next. He wants the history. From the moment someone first thought of weather as a physics problem you could solve with equations, through Richardson's mad attempt to compute a forecast by hand, the first computer models after the war, the big operational centers, and the discovery of chaos that put a hard ceiling on the whole enterprise. Then he wants the uses, not in the abstract, but where a forecast actually turns into a decision with money or lives on the line. Aviation, shipping, flood warning, military planning, the works.
That's a lot of ground.
And then he wants the AI story. What machine learning is doing in this space, whether it's replacing physics models or just bolted onto them, and a skeptical read on the new learned global forecasters, what they're good at, what they can't do, and the awkward fact that they're all trained on reanalysis data from the physics models they're supposedly going to replace. Also, keep weather prediction and climate projection separate. They're different problems on different timescales. People mix them up constantly, and we shouldn't.
That last one. Yes. Weather is an initial value problem. You take the state of the atmosphere right now and run it forward. Climate is a boundary value problem. You change the composition of the atmosphere and ask what the new equilibrium looks like. Completely different mathematical beasts. People use the same word, model, for both and assume it's the same thing. It's not.
So where does the idea of calculating the weather even start?
Wilhelm Bjerknes, 1904. He was a Norwegian physicist and he published a paper that basically said, the atmosphere is a fluid obeying the laws of physics, so if you know its current state and you have the equations that govern it, you can compute its future state. He laid out the problem as a set of 7 partial differential equations: conservation of momentum, conservation of mass, the ideal gas law, the first law of thermodynamics, and the continuity equation for water vapor. And he said, look, we know the equations, we just need enough observations and enough computing power.
Which in 1904 was, people with pencils.
People with pencils, exactly. Bjerknes knew the equations were unsolvable analytically. You can't just integrate them and get a nice formula. You'd have to do it numerically, step by step, across a grid covering the whole atmosphere. He understood the vision perfectly. He just didn't have the means.
Enter Lewis Fry Richardson.
Richardson was, I love this man, he was a Quaker, a pacifist, he drove an ambulance in the First World War, and in his spare time between the trenches he was working on the first numerical weather forecast. He took Bjerknes' equations and actually tried to compute a forecast by hand.
By hand?
He divided Europe into a grid, collected observations from a single day, May 20th, 1910, and spent months doing arithmetic. The forecast was for a 6-hour period over Central Europe, and it predicted a pressure change of 145 millibars in 6 hours.
Which is...
physically impossible. The real change was essentially zero. His calculation was off by 2 orders of magnitude. Richardson knew it was wrong, and he spent years figuring out why. The core problem was that his numerical method was unstable. Tiny errors in the initial wind field would amplify catastrophically with each time step. He wrote a book about it in 1922 called Weather Prediction by Numerical Process, and in it he described this extraordinary vision of a forecast factory.
The forecast factory.
A giant circular hall like a theater, with a map of the globe painted on the walls. In the gallery, thousands of human computers. He imagined 64,000 of them, each one calculating the equations for a small patch of the globe. A conductor at the center, shining colored lights to coordinate the calculations, sending runners with numbers between the sections. He imagined computing the weather faster than the weather itself happens, so you'd actually get a forecast before the weather arrived.
64,000 people with slide rules, coordinated by a man with a spotlight. It's the most beautiful thing that never worked.
It's completely wonderful. and he was right about almost everything except the instability problem. He even anticipated parallel computing, the idea that you'd divide the globe into subdomains and compute them simultaneously. That's exactly how modern weather models work on supercomputers. He just didn't have the mathematical tools to handle the error growth. Those came later.
So the war ends, and suddenly, there are machines that can do arithmetic without human computers.
ENIAC. 1950. John von Neumann, who'd been working on the Manhattan Project, saw weather prediction as the perfect test case for electronic computers. He assembled a team at Princeton, and in March 1950, they ran the first successful numerical weather forecast on ENIAC. It took about 24 hours of computation to produce a 24-hour forecast.
Barely breaking even.
Barely. But it worked. The forecast wasn't great by modern standards, but it was recognizably a weather forecast. It captured the large-scale pressure patterns. That was the proof of concept. After that, things accelerated fast. The U.S. Weather Bureau set up a numerical prediction unit in 1954. By the late 50s, operational numerical weather prediction was running daily.
And the big centers, ECMWF, NOAA, when do they arrive?
NOAA's National Meteorological Center, which later became NSEPPA, was established in the 50s and really scaled up through the 60s and 70s. ECMWF, the European Center for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts, was founded in 1975. It was a European response to the fact that the Americans were pulling ahead. The idea was, pool resources, build one world-class center with a single massive computer and a single model, and make the best medium-range forecasts on the planet. It worked. ECMWF is still probably the premier global forecasting center.
And the models themselves. You mentioned barotropic toy grids. What was the trajectory?
The earliest models were barotropic. They treated the atmosphere as a single layer with no vertical structure. That's fine for capturing large-scale waves in the jet stream, but it can't produce clouds, can't produce precipitation, can't handle fronts. Through the 60s and 70s, models added vertical layers, added moisture, added radiation, added parameterizations for things like turbulence and convection that happen at scales smaller than the grid cells. By the 80s, you had full global spectral models with dozens of vertical levels, and by the 2000s, you had models with grids fine enough to start resolving individual storms.
And at some point in this story, Edward Lorenz walks in and ruins everything.
1961. Lorenz was running a simple weather model on a small computer at MIT, a toy model with just 12 variables, nothing like a real forecast. He wanted to rerun a section of a previous simulation, so he typed in the numbers from a printout, but the printout had rounded to 3 decimal places while the computer was using 6. The difference was one part in 1,000, and the rerun diverged completely.
The butterfly.
The butterfly was actually a later talk he gave. Predictability. Does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? But the discovery was that moment in 61. A deterministic system, governed by exact equations, with no randomness anywhere, can produce behavior that's unpredictable beyond a certain horizon because tiny differences in the initial state grow exponentially. That's the predictability horizon. For weather, it's about 2 weeks. No matter how good your model is, no matter how many observations you have, the errors in your initial conditions will eventually swamp the forecast.
And that's not a computing problem. That's a property of the atmosphere.
It's a property of the equations. It's built into the physics. You can't engineer your way around it. What you can do is run the model many times with slightly different initial conditions and see how the forecasts diverge. That's ensemble forecasting.
Which is why, when you look at a hurricane track forecast, you see a cone, not a line.
The cone is the spread of the ensemble. A tight cone means the members agree, high confidence. A wide cone means the atmosphere is in a chaotic regime where small differences matter a lot. Ensemble forecasting started operationally in the 90s at ECMWF and NCEP, and it's now standard practice everywhere. It's the honest response to chaos. Instead of pretending you know the one true forecast, you quantify your uncertainty.
All right. So we've got the physics, the computing, the chaos, the ensembles. Let's talk about where this actually touches the world. You mentioned aviation. What does a forecast become a decision?
Aviation is the cleanest example. Every commercial flight files a flight plan that depends on forecast winds aloft. The jet stream can add or subtract 100 knots of ground speed. If you get the winds wrong, you burn more fuel than planned, and fuel is the single largest variable cost for an airline. Worse, you might not have enough fuel to reach your destination with legal reserves. Airlines have entire dispatch teams whose job is to integrate weather forecasts into routing decisions, and they're making choices with tens of thousands of dollars of fuel on the line per flight.
And shipping?
Container ships route around storms. A North Atlantic storm can add 2 days to a crossing and burn hundreds of thousands of dollars in extra fuel. The optimal route is a calculation that balances forecast winds, waves, and currents against the cost of deviation. The shipping companies subscribe to specialized forecast services, not the public weather forecast, but bespoke marine forecasts optimized for their specific routes and vessel characteristics.
Agriculture. That's the one I think of as the oldest use case. Farmers have been trying to read the weather since they were farmers.
And now, it's incredibly quantitative. Planting decisions depend on soil temperature and moisture forecasts. Irrigation scheduling depends on evapotranspiration forecasts. Harvest timing depends on precipitation forecasts. You don't want to cut hay if rain is coming in 3 days, because hay needs to dry in the field. And then there's the pesticide and fertilizer application. You need wind forecasts to avoid drift, and you need rain forecasts because a downpour right after application washes everything into the waterways. The economic value of a good seasonal forecast to agriculture is in the billions globally.
Energy grid. Renewable scheduling, you said.
Wind and solar are the obvious ones. A wind farm operator needs to know what the wind speed will be at turbine hub height, typically 80 to 100 meters up, for the next 24 to 48 hours to bid into the electricity market. Solar is somewhat easier because cloud cover is the main variable and the sun's position is deterministic. But the grid operator has the harder problem. They need to balance supply and demand in real time, and renewables introduce variability on the supply side that used to be completely controllable. A bad wind forecast can mean firing up a gas peaker plant at the last minute, which is expensive and emits carbon. A good forecast saves money and emissions simultaneously.
Insurance and catastrophe modeling. That's where the money gets really large.
Catastrophe modeling is a whole industry. The big firms, AIR Worldwide, RMS, now Moody's, build models that simulate tens of thousands of synthetic hurricane tracks, or earthquake scenarios, or flood events, and estimate the probability distribution of losses for a given portfolio of properties. Weather forecasts feed into this in real time. When a hurricane is actually approaching, the models shift from climatological probabilities to conditional forecasts based on the current track and intensity predictions. That's what determines whether an insurer issues a binding restriction, a notice that no new policies can be written in certain ZIP codes until the storm passes.
Flood warning is the one where the forecast directly saves lives.
Flood forecasting is a chain. The meteorological forecast tells you how much rain will fall where. That feeds into a hydrological model that tells you how that rain will translate into river discharge. That feeds into a hydraulic model that tells you which areas will flood and to what depth. Each link in the chain has its own errors, and the errors compound. The European Flood Awareness System, EFS, runs ensemble forecasts out to 10 days and issues alerts to national authorities. The decision point is, do you evacuate? Evacuating a town costs millions and disrupts thousands of lives. Not evacuating when you should have costs lives. That's a decision made on the basis of a probabilistic forecast, and it's about as high stakes as civilian forecasting gets.
And military planning. That's the one Daniel flagged that most people don't think about.
The military runs its own weather models. The U.S. Air Force has the 507th Weather Wing, which operates a global forecast model separate from NOAA's. They care about things civilian forecasters don't. Visibility for helicopter pilots, sea state for amphibious operations, upper-level winds for paradrops, atmospheric refractivity for radar and communications. During the Gulf War, the forecasts for wind direction mattered because of the chemical weapons threat. If the wind shifted, a Scud attack with chemical warheads could drift over your own troops. The military also has a long history of weather modification research, cloud seeding over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam, for instance, but that's a different and much darker story.
All right. That's the physics-based world. Now the part where everything gets disrupted. How did machine learning get into weather forecasting?
It crept in through the side doors first. The core of a weather model is the dynamical core, the fluid dynamic solver that moves the atmosphere forward in time. That's pure physics, and for decades it was untouchable. But around the dynamical core, there are dozens of parameterizations, sub-grid processes that can't be resolved directly, like cloud formation, turbulence, convection, radiative transfer. Those parameterizations are semi-empirical. They're tuned by hand. And about 10 years ago, people started asking, what if we replace some of these with learned models trained on high-resolution simulations or observations?
So initially, ML wasn't replacing the model. It was improving the bits the model couldn't do well.
Post-processing, too. Taking the raw model output and correcting its systematic biases using a learned mapping from past forecasts to past observations. That's been standard practice for years, and nobody calls it AI. They just call it model output statistics. Data assimilation. The process of blending observations with a short-term forecast to produce the initial conditions for the next forecast has also started incorporating machine learning, though that's harder because assimilation is a Bayesian inference problem with very strong physical constraints.
And then the emulators arrived.
The emulators. The idea here is, you have a physics-based model that's very expensive to run. You run it many times, generate a training data set of inputs and outputs, and then train a neural network to approximate the mapping. The neural network runs thousands of times faster. This has been done successfully for specific tasks, emulating the radiation scheme, for instance, which is one of the most expensive parts of a climate model. But it's still a copy of the physics model. It can outperform it.
And then the big shift, the learned global forecast models.
This is the thing everyone's talking about. Starting around 2022, a series of papers showed that you could train a deep neural network directly on reanalysis data. ERA5 from ECMWF is the standard, and produce a global forecast that's competitive with the operational physics-based models. The big names, GraphCast from Google DeepMind, ForecastNet from NVIDIA, Penggu Weather from Huawei, and now AIFS from ECMWF itself.
And reanalysis data is?
It's the output of a physics-based model that's been run retrospectively, assimilating all available historical observations to produce the best possible estimate of what the atmosphere was doing at every point in time. ERA5 goes back to 1940. It's the gold standard, and is produced by ECMWF's integrated forecasting system, the very physics model these AI systems are being compared against.
So they're trained on the output of the thing they're supposed to replace.
Yes. That's the awkward fact Daniel mentioned. These models learn to imitate the physics model. If the physics model has systematic biases, and it does, the AI model will inherit them. It might even amplify them. And if you ask the AI model to forecast something that's outside the distribution of its training data, an unprecedented heat wave, say, or a storm of an intensity that never appeared in ERA5, there's no guarantee it'll behave physically.
But they're fast.
They're absurdly fast. GraphCast produces a 10-day global forecast in under a minute on a single TPU. The ECMWF operational model takes hours on a supercomputer with thousands of nodes. The energy savings alone are enormous. And on standard skill scores, root means square error of 500 hectopascal geopotential height, that sort of thing. GraphCast matches or beats the operational model on most variables out to about 10 days.
So what's the skeptical read?
Several things. First, the skill scores are averages over a test set. They don't tell you about performance on the most extreme events, which are the ones you actually care about. Second, these models are deterministic. They produce a single forecast. You can make an ensemble by adding noise to the initial conditions or by training multiple models, but the ensemble spread may not be well calibrated. Third, they don't conserve mass or energy. A physics model enforces conservation laws by construction. A neural network doesn't. It learns to approximate them from data, and it could drift. Over a 10-day forecast, the drift is small, but if you tried to run one of these models out to a season or a year, it'd probably produce nonsense.
And that's where the weather versus climate distinction bites hardest.
Climate models need to conserve energy to within a fraction of a watt per square meter over centuries. If they drift, the whole simulation becomes unphysical. AI weather models don't have that constraint, and it's not clear they can acquire it from data alone. For weather forecasting out to 10 or 15 days, the speed and skill of the learned models is impressive, and they'll almost certainly become operational. For climate projection, what happens to the monsoon in a world with 600 parts per million of carbon dioxide? You still need a physics-based model that respects conservation laws. The two problems aren't interchangeable.
And the other thing, these models predict what the atmosphere will do, but they don't tell you why.
That's the interpretability problem. A physics model has a diabatic heating rate you can inspect. You can trace a forecast feature back to a specific physical process. With a neural network, you get a number. You can do attribution studies, ablate an input, see how the forecast changes, but it's not the same as having a causal physical understanding. For operational forecasters, that matters. When the model predicts something unusual, they want to know whether it's seeing a real physical signal or hallucinating.
And yet, a minute on a single chip versus hours on a supercomputer, that's not a small difference.
It's not, and I think the most likely near-term future is hybrid. You use the fast AI model to run a massive ensemble, hundreds of members, exploring the full probability space, and then you use the physics model to verify the most concerning scenarios. Or you use the AI model for the first 7 days and then hand off to the physics model for the extended range. Or you use the AI model as a proposal generator for the data assimilation system. There are a lot of architectures being explored, and the field is moving extremely fast.
The other thing that strikes me, all of this is downstream of the observation network. If the satellites go dark, or the weather balloon program gets cut, or the aircraft reports stop coming, the models have nothing to assimilate. AI or physics doesn't matter.
That's the unglamorous infrastructure layer that makes everything else possible. The Global Observing System is a patchwork of satellites, radio sondes, surface stations, aircraft, buoys, and radar, coordinated through the World Meteorological Organization. It's expensive, and it's fragile. During COVID, the loss of aircraft observations, because commercial flights were grounded, measurably degraded forecast skill. The aircraft provide temperature and wind profiles at cruise altitude that nothing else can match. The system is more robust than it looks, but it's not infinitely robust.
And the satellites are the backbone now.
Polar orbiting satellites give you global temperature and moisture soundings twice a day. Geostationary satellites give you continuous imagery and atmospheric motion vectors. You track cloud features from one image to the next and infer the wind. The big leap in forecast skill in the Southern Hemisphere over the last 40 years is almost entirely due to satellite data. Before satellites, the Southern Ocean was a data desert. Now it's well observed, and the forecasts are nearly as good as the Northern Hemisphere. I'm going to stop there because I want to hear what Hilbert thinks of all this. There's no way he doesn't have an angle on weather forecasting.
The Met Office, Bracknell. 1987. I was in the mailroom.
Of course you were.
October 15th, 1987. The Great Storm. Michael Fish went on the BBC the night before and told everyone not to worry. A woman had called in about a hurricane, and he said there wasn't one coming. Then the storm hit. 22 people died, 15 million trees down. I was in the mailroom the next morning, and nobody was talking. The place was silent.
The forecast missed it.
The model said the storm would track up the channel. It didn't. It went across southern England. The French model got it right. The French model.
That storm is a famous case study. The observing network missed a key feature in the initial conditions, a small low-pressure center that deepened explosively.
After that, they bought more computing power. The Treasury opened the purse. A bad forecast that kills people is the best thing that ever happens to a forecasting center's budget. Nobody wants to hear that, but it's true.
There's a grim logic to it.
The other thing nobody talks about is the fax machines. In 1987, the forecasts went out by fax. If the fax machine jammed, the forecast didn't arrive. We had a whole room of fax machines and a man whose job was to unjam them. His name was Keith. He had a stick.
A stick.
He'd walk up and down the rows, and if a machine started making the noise, the grinding noise, he'd whack it on the side with the stick. Worked about 60% of the time.
What happened? The other 40%?
We'd get a call from an RAF base asking where their forecast was, and we'd say it's in the machine, and they'd say get it out of the machine, and we'd say we're trying. Keith retired in 94. They gave him a plaque. The plaque said, "For services to facsimile transmission, I'm not joking.
The whole edifice of numerical weather prediction. Bjerknes, Richardson, von Neumann, the supercomputers, the satellites, the ensembles, and it all depends on a man with a stick.
It did for a while. The stick was a broom handle with gaffer tape around the end. I still have it.
Of course you do.
Keith gave it to me when he left. Said I'd need it. I did.
The thing that strikes me about that story is that it's not really about the model. The model might be excellent, but the chain from the model output to the decision, that's where the failure happens. The fax machine, the interpretation, the communication. The forecast can be right and still be useless if it doesn't reach the person who needs it in a form they can act on.
The forecast for the 87 storm was wrong, but the French one wasn't, and nobody in England saw the French forecast because there was no system for sharing them. The Met Office got the French output on a telex, but the duty forecaster didn't look at it because he was busy with the UK model. That's not a physics problem, that's a human problem.
One forecaster, one telex, one decision not to look.
That's the whole thing. Everyone thinks weather forecasting is about the equations. It's not. It's about whether the person on shift trusts the output of the foreign model more than their own, at 2 a.m, with a storm coming. And most of the time, they don't.
The AI models change that calculus, though. If the French model runs on a laptop in 30 seconds, there's no reason not to look at it.
There's always a reason not to look at it. The reason is, you've got 17 things to look at, and you're tired. The technology changes. The human doesn't.
I think that's about right. We've been talking about the arc of prediction, Bjerknes to Graphcast, but Hilbert's point is that the last meter, the bit where the forecast meets the decision, hasn't fundamentally changed. It's still a person, looking at information, under time pressure, making a call. And that's where the failures happen, and where the successes happen too.
The stick is optional.
The stick is never optional.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, who apparently owns a piece of meteorological history and a broom handle with gaffer tape.
If you want more episodes, we're at myweirdprompts.com. New episodes every day. We'll be back tomorrow.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.